Hi, this is Bill Teeple, Alan Cobb, and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. Last night, my friend and icon artist, David Hansen, sent me an email of an article by Susie Gablick, who's a very well-known contemporary art critic that is questioning the role of art in our age and where it's going, and talking about a new paradigm shift in the arts. This particular article raises an issue of how her approach to a kind of a moral imperative for art contrasts to the art for art's sake status of art in the modernist period, and more than solving the solution, she's sort of making her stand here. She raises the issue of the two angles, and that's what I would like to actually discuss today. So I'm going to read a little bit of this article. I hope I don't bore you with reading too much, to kind of set the stage, and then we can get into this discussion. She wrote this book called Has Modernism Failed, and she's taking this particular role about the artist's role in society. And
I'm so glad you're saying that.
I'm setting the stage. Now I'm going to read. Several years later, I was invited to participate in a panel discussion organized by the College Art Association on the moral imperative in art. I remember feeling extremely queasy about how to address the topic, which felt a bit like a landmine or a trap. Anybody who knows the history of modernism will be aware that art in that era was extremely object-oriented and uncluttered. White cube spaces were central to its exhibition aesthetic. There was no obvious way in which spiritual or moral values fit in, and obviously I had no clue how to proceed. This is Susie Gablick's kind of angle on things. When only a few weeks were left in which to compose my talk for the conference, I was still absolutely stymied. It was then that the universe intervened and offered me the missing piece. It arrived in the form of a package in the mail sent by an artist I hardly knew in Santa Fe, Dominique Maziard, and it contained a section of manuscript she was writing, entitled My Riveries. The document was a diary account of her new art project describing the once-a-month ritual pilgrimages she made to the Rio Grande River, armed with garbage bags donated by the city to clean pollution out of the dying river. She did this regularly and without fail for 7 years. It was not just the undertaking itself that moved me. When I read the descriptions of what she felt while engaged in this activity, I wept. I also recognized in my friend's river project the possibility of a whole new spiritual and moral imperative for art. At the conference, I listened to the other presenters, all of them important artists, critics, and museum curators, as they uniformly made the same unblinking argument. Namely, that there is no moral imperative in art because for art to play a useful or moral role in society would make it a tool, no longer a valuable end in itself. The only moral imperative for artists, they argued, was a dedication to making the very best art they could. This was vintage art world modernism, a philosophy of autonomy well summed up by the sculptor Louise Nevelson, who once said, "If they blow up the world, that's not my business. My business is to work. Art is art, after all, and life is life, and ne'er the twain shall meet." That was Susie Gablick. As next to the last speaker at the conference, I knew I was on hazardous terrain with what I was about to say. Art does have a moral imperative. It can be useful in solving social and environmental problems, and not just aesthetic ones. To support my premise, I shared excerpts from my friend's diary. I don't even need to go on any further for us to do the setup.
Well, there was one point you made when you first mentioned this article, which had to do with the contrast of this artist collecting trash, which at first glance doesn't sound like an art form, and the $70 million painting.
Let's see if I can find anything about that here. I might just go ahead and say it. She Well, she delivered the talk, and although she thought she would be rejected by all these critics, they gave her a standing ovation because somehow she had stirred in them the beauty of this innocent act that was a very beautiful artistic act, yes, it was outside the context of the art world. Then she contrasts that with despite all these apocalyptic threats, the turbocharged art world goes on as before, lunging ever forward with kangaroo speed along the same market-driven parameters and without any moral imperative at all. During the spring art auction at Sotheby's in New York in 2007, for instance, over $72 million were paid for a Mark Rothko painting done in 1950, the largest sum ever paid at auction for contemporary work. The following night at Christie's, an Andy Warhol painting from 1963, Green Car Crash, from his disaster series sold for $71 million. English artist Damien Hirst routinely sells spot paintings of colored circles for $1 million, and he has done nearly 1,000 of them, knowing they will sell a month later for double the price. Good news of this sort is reportedly regular in art magazines with the pride of the doomed. So here we have the setup. The setup does art have a purpose in just its enlivenment of beauty? Is the beauty that's stirred in culture by the for its own sake art object have moral value? Does the artist have a moral responsibility to society to have his work be something that helps change the world in a good direction, sort of an activist point of view, which has been more actually a postmodernist point of view? Or is everyone just a slave to a market-driven, commodity-oriented industry that we're all a part of and can't get away from, that is just another expression of capitalism? I don't know. Does anybody have any thoughts on these things?
Well, it's a complicated, you know, there's not a black and white in this, because there, just as you were talking about the art for art's sake people and the painters who are just pursuing their own vision, whatever it happens to be, and me as a person who's going into a museum and looking at these pieces of art, you used one example of a Rothko painting in that room that we've mentioned before, I think on our radio show, the room at the Tate Gallery in London, where there are 9 Rothko paintings all in the same room. And people go into that room and literally have a spiritual experience in the room. It's like a chapel, and he actually meant it to be that way, and these paintings to all be together like that. So even though he and other artists have sold, maybe in spite of himself, he entered that realm of selling his paintings for high sums of money. And who knows what his motivation was, even if we read accounts of why he decided to paint that way, we don't really know what was going on inside him. But even so, there's some moral, or I don't know if moral is the right word to use, but some positive benefit to the world that seems to have come from the existence of those paintings for certain people who go and view them. And that's true for any of the painters. For an individual work of art, by, let's say, Picasso, who is maybe more controversial, the same exact painting by Picasso could make someone go into the room and go, "Oh, that is so ugly. How could anybody call that art?" And somebody else may go in and be extremely moved by it and blown away, and it could change their whole direction as an artist or a perceiver of life. So I don't think it's a simple
issue. Oh, it's not simple at all. In fact, the point that I have made is that what I'm trying to do with the Garden Studio is to create a place where this, the resolution of these forces can take place in the context of my own existence. Because I don't think it's an either or situation at all. I left the art world for 15 years because I was disgusted with the commodity-based nature of the thing and the markets orientation of the whole thing, and that it seemed to be in going into a dead end. And I had to come to terms with that I was actually rejecting something that was a fact, and that we have to deal with the fact of that the art world looks like this today, but it doesn't take away from the fact that that thing that's being traded as a commodity has an absolutely practical value in society, because when you stand in front of that Mark Rothko painting or deeply conceived work of art, you are transformed and changed, and I believe for the better, and so that the whole of society is moved forward towards a higher reality because of the existence of that thing that some people trade as commodities.
And there was, you know, on the other hand, there was that shift in Russia where all art, you know, a lot of the good Russian artists like Kandinsky and people like that had to leave because their things, you know, the government decided that art had to be used for the benefit of society, and all the artists had to do these paintings that had to show, you know, where the society wanted to go. And you look at, and those particular works of art nowadays have a little sort of campy appeal, but they're not like Kandinsky's, you know, they don't take you to the deep level that the artists, that their society was rejecting, were getting to, because they had their own view of morality and how art should play into it. So sometimes, you know, I think that this is the example that Susie Gablick gave of this woman who took the pollution, the cans and things out of the river. That is a beautiful thing to do.
And her the thing she was touching on there was the aesthetic experience that the person was having.
Right, right.
It was a daily act for 7 years. That was a ritual performance. It was almost a spiritual act or a shamanic performance.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
And I think this is what she's trying to raise our awareness to, that these simple things, that there are simple aesthetic acts that people are performing, which is not unlike what I was attempting to do in that 15 years, was to bring my aesthetic nature to the level of washing one's dishes and cleaning behind the toilet and all of this, having there be no difference between that, even though you get no recognition in the art world, it's the same thing in a way.
But you have to, it has to be a both and not an either.
I agree,
you know,
I totally agree.
It's not like, okay, now we should all go in this direction and approach our art in that way, because like we were talking about in another show, the personal impetus or calling that every artist has is just what it is, and it can inspire one artist to work like we're sitting in the gallery right now, surrounded by Judy Bale's works of beautiful works of sculpture made of industrial materials that another artist may reject and say that's not really art, and yet she's created this magnificent art from it. Another person may feel like, I'm only going to work with materials from nature because I don't want anything artificial to come into my art. And that, for that artist, is the path that is most meaningful to them. So broad-mindedness, I think, in all of us is important in a topic like this.
Another aspect of it is that the artist who cleaned up the river was both documented by herself and curated by the critic who wrote about her. And without those two elements, it would have been a strictly personal work. I mean, you could still call it a work of art. I mean, we've said from the beginning of this radio show, that of this series, that anything that someone does kind of, you know, knowingly and with an emphasis on self-expression and exploration has to be included in the realm of art, whether they think of it as art or not, and whether anyone knows they did it or not. And ultimately, you know, when you go to define it, of course, you need so many definitions that you aren't really defining anything at all. You're just saying, well, life, and you might as well skip it if you're gonna. Although, you know, it's still, it's worth trying to define art so that you can see why it can't be defined.
What we have that for better or for worse is a certain kind of structure that we call the art world. And you can move your acts, your creative acts, into that structure or not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of beautiful creative acts are not moved into that structure, and no one knows about them in the context of that structure. They might, in the local newspaper, you know, you saved a puppy or something, but saving that puppy or the puppy can be moved into, or puppy ness or puppy love. I mean, there's so many things that you can take almost anything and move it into that structure.
Like that Jeff Koons.
That's what I was thinking.
Is there the big puppy sculpture?
Yeah. You can move something into that structure, and then it becomes a game piece. Yeah. In a thing called the art world. I often talk about let's think of eliminating that, and having our acts be just judged on their effect. And that's an, I mean, these are the, I haven't come to any solution here. I think that a context that allows more flexibility for looking at the whole picture is interesting to me. And that's what I call the garden studio.
Yeah. But somehow to live that way and have, you know, be able to support yourself and buy your food and, you know, your shelter and all that, you have to... No, you know, if somebody wants to be a full-time artist and make their living and support themselves that way, they have to enter the system to some degree. And that's what, you know, all the stories about the great artists, Monet and Picasso and Matisse and all of those people, Cézanne, some of them were not able to do that. They weren't able to earn money from their art until maybe late in their life or never, and were struggling and frustrated and having to take other jobs or depend on other people. Some of them got patrons and some of them didn't. But I think that the draw to artists who really don't want to be part of the system, who choose that they just have to anyway, it's just that to them it's better to be able to work as an artist all the time and not have to earn a living in any other way than to try to just maintain their ideals on the side and work in an office or something like that.
Well, most artists figure out some kind of way to work with the system that's intact in their time and place. They either go in there and they stand their ground, and one dealer shows their work, maybe, and eventually the society goes that way, or maybe the society doesn't go that way. I don't see any reason why we can't entertain possibilities that don't look like the way it looks today. When I talk about one garden studio and another garden studio and another garden studio, with artists being more in a nucleus of their own artistic reality and not having to break it so much for the nature of the commodity-oriented gallery scene that we have today, that is a pleasing thought to me. I don't know how to get there, but it's an interesting it's just entertaining a different way of it, in which case the society would have to cherish the artists enough to help them set up this. In other words, a different kind of patronage system would have to be envisioned. Perhaps we need to go back a little bit more to a patronage system and get a little bit away from the immediate investment nature of trading these art commodities.
Because what they have to cherish, the patrons or whoever supports this kind of thing, is the process of the artist, rather than some collector's whim, you know, some collector that gets taken by visiting someone's basement studio and goes, "Whoa, I've never seen anything like this. This is like the latest thing," and suddenly brings it out into the open, and that all of a sudden becomes the popular artist to collect from, you know, and then everybody's buying that artist's work. Instead, it would be a wonderful thing if people's awareness of art were awakened to what we've talked about in many, many shows of the inner, pretty spiritual pursuit of following one's path as an artist.
I wouldn't mind being a part of a movement that torques the thing away from where it is now, as described in her paragraph here, towards a system where you more make a pilgrimage to the spiritual place that this artist is sitting in, and you can commune with his soul, and it's not so much a matter of like the trendy thing is to own one of these so everyone is out, you know, and then all the piranhas are feeding on the situation.
Yeah, I mean, people are buying those $71 million paintings not because they're trendy, but in some cases, they're buying them because they're $71 million, not because of what they are as paintings. Mm-hmm. And in other cases, they're buying them because they think they will soon be $120 million.
Well, the Damien Hirst spot that sells for $1 million, but she knows would double in price in a month.
Yeah.
They're buying it so they can get, you know, turn around and sell it and make money. So
yeah, that doesn't have anything to do with art at all.
I think some people don't necessarily want to turn around and sell it, but they want to have the prestige of owning an original so-and-so.
Yeah.
And there is, you know, you can completely get awestruck by something like that. Well, you know, Leonor's mother owns a Picasso plate that she got many years ago, and when I visited her in California and I saw this Picasso plate, I was just like gaga over this. It's like, oh my. And she just recently, you know, and he said she just recently gave it to him. He's got it in his little apartment, and it's just this. I'm awestruck by that.
But it shows the power that an object can take on.
It can, because you just, you know, you feel that there's this connection that you have with this person you admire.
And there's so many levels that are involved with imbuing that object with this magical power. Mm. I mean, you obviously have a deep-seated direct response and reverence for Picasso. So when you see the object that was, you know, comes from his hands, there's a reverence for that object. Apart from just the aesthetic experience that you're having of it, there's more to it than that. And this guy that paid $71 million for the Rothko could also be just displaying his deep-seated reverence for Rothko, because he does, you know, this is where we sort things out too. We also see that Rothko is one of the great artistic beings, great artists of our time, and that price reflects his status in the whole thing.
How many more minutes do we have left?
So we haven't really, we've come around in a circle. We're circling this topic, I think. I think this is a huge topic.
It's not something there's something that you feel needs to be changed. There needs
that
to be
some
change need to take place.
Yeah.
And I feel like we are the vehicles for that change.
Mm-hmm.
And so in attempting to, that it's something we need to attempt to resolve. And that's the art seems to be, rather than captured within the frame as it used to be, it seems to be all around us now, and we seem to be part of it. It's like we're in the middle of an artwork, trying to resolve it, like we're trying to resolve a painting we're painting. We're in the middle of one, trying to resolve it.
And maybe the attempt, like when you said we have to attempt to resolve it, maybe the attempt is more about peeling away the filters that have been overlaid, you know, on pure art, whatever pure art or pure creation might
well,
be.
And I think that's been our injunction in this radio series,
yeah,
is to try to peel away some of those filters and veils to get at what it's really all about.
Mm-hmm. And we have to acknowledge that peeling away is different at different levels of consciousness, because you can't see things as they really are. You can only peel away the particular interpretations that you're currently aware of, and hopefully aware enough of that you can peel them away. But there are other layers of interpretation and other filters and things impinging on our perception of things and our valuation and our judgment of things that we don't even know we're doing. And we, as we discover them, we can peel them away, but there may be other things, and there are maybe things that we used to have peeled away that have crept back as our attention moves on to some of the other things we can peel away.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.